It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Michael Reed Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Wednesday morning, the 24th of April. Good morning. With much debate and discussion from now till 11 a.m, this is Michael Reid on LMFM. Yesterday, Taoiseach Simon Harris spoke from the floor of the Dáil to the Stardust family, saying, on behalf of the state, we are sorry. We failed you when you needed us the most. From the very beginning, we should have stood with you, but instead, we forced you to stand against us. 48 young people lost their lives in the Stardust disaster. Many more were injured, and even more still had their lives broken and shattered forever. In delivering the state apology, the Taoiseach said he hoped it was a moment when the state, which rubbed salt in the family's terrible wounds, starts to help them to heal. Simon Harris paid tribute to the people working in the Stardust, the waiters, the waitresses, the doormen, the DJs, thinking of the frontline workers who fought to save lives on the night, the fire crews, the ambulance and hospital staff, the Gardaí, the army, the taxi drivers. The Taoiseach apologised for a suspicion cast on those who had died or survived on that catastrophic night. He spoke of the pain and grief compounded by stigma and rejection. Families forced to fight for decades to obtain the vindication they won last Thursday when the inquest returned a verdict of unlawful killing in the case of the 48 family members who died back in 1981. The Taoiseach told the families, you did nothing wrong. The institutions of the state, he said, failed you. The institutions of the state, he said, let you down. These brave families should never have had to walk alone. We should have been by your side. We should have walked with you. We were not. We did not. And for that, we are truly sorry. The Taoiseach went on to say that counselling should have been offered. We should have provided answers. We should have ensured that the truth came out. And for all of this, the Taoiseach then said that on behalf of the state, he apologised unreservedly to all of the families of the Stardust victims and all of the survivors for the hurt that was done to them and for the profoundly painful years of struggle for truth. He apologised to the families that those present on the night of the fire were wrongly criminalised through the allegation of arson, which was an attack on their reputations. The Taoiseach told the Dáil that every person who was in the Stardust on St. Valentine's Night 1981 was innocent. Not only were they innocent, he said, they were unlawfully killed. Each of the 48 young people who were unlawfully killed in the Stardust in February 1981 were remembered. Michael Barrett,
who was working that night as an assistant DJ, he was wise beyond his years. He had an infectious laugh. He was 17 years old.
Richard Bennett,
who loved the horses and took on the role of breadwinner for his family, described as an angel in disguise. He was 17.
Carol Bissett,
a singer in the choir, the girl guide, quiet in her ways, much loved by all. She was 18.
Jimmy Buckley,
the life of every party, who loved hurling and had won a competition for his Elvis impression. Father figure, brother, hero, He was 23.
Paula Byrne.
Always the peacemaker. She loved to draw, was the epitome of kindness. She was 19.
Caroline Carey.
A talented Irish dancer who took up disco dancing. A Dublin City Council clerical officer who'd recently found out she was going to be a mother. Her family asked me to tell this house today that this baby was the 49th victim of the Stardust tragedy. Caroline was 17.
Johnny Colgan.
Johnny, always upbeat. He lit up every room and performed the Hucklebuck as his party piece. He was going to be an uncle. He was 21.
Jacqueline Croker.
A heart of gold who brought music into her family's lives on her red record player and used her wages to dress and treat her brothers and sisters. She was 18.
Liam Dunn.
Training to be a butcher, which he loved, with a passion for music. He was a loving boy with many friends. He was 18.
Michael Farrell.
His family's bundle of joy. He worked at Cadbury. A dapper young man who always tried to look his best. He was a deep thinker. A diarist. He was 26.
Michael French.
Horsey. An auto electrician. And the rock of his family. A role model who worked hard to share his wages and thought of everyone else before himself. He was 18.
David Flood.
A rocker at heart who loved the guitar and was known for his Jagger swagger. He never missed a day of work and he had all of life's possibilities ahead of him. He was 18.
Thelma Fraser.
Gentle. Kind. Loved Friday nights and disco moves. Remembered by her brothers and her sisters for her treats, her hugs, her kisses. She was 20.
Josephine Glenn.
Quiet. Gentle. Always smiling and happy. A second mam to her brothers and sisters. She left school to help support her family. She was 16.
Michael Griffiths.
Happy, outgoing, with a great, great work ethic and a generous nature. He loved family occasions. He loved Christmas and could always be heard laughing, singing, playing music. He was 18.
Robert Hillock.
Bobby. Outgoing, hardworking. He loved football and boxing. He was very close to his late brother Bill. He was 20.
Brian Hobbs.
Mr. was known as his Mammy Pat. He was academically inclined. He excelled at Catering College, winning a gold medal for Ireland in competition. He was ambitious. He was going places. He was 21.
Eugene Hogan.
A skilled carpenter, a sharp dresser with a beautiful voice who could hit the high notes, a loving, caring father. He was 24.
Myrta Kavanagh.
Caring. Kind, good-natured. He was a heating insulator who looked after his father. He loved the Dubs and Man United. He was 27.
Martina Keegan.
Not just a daughter and a sister, but a best friend and a confidant. She dreamed of being a model. She was studious and hard-working.
Mary Keegan.
Beautiful inside and out. Shy at heart, but very fun-loving and sociable. A teacher to her younger siblings. She excelled at school and work. She was 19.
Robert Kelly.
Nicknamed Spiky for his hairstyle. He worked on the B&I boats and loved it. He was a lover of music and embroidery. He was 17.
Marie Kennedy.
Warm, caring, lively and fiercely protective. Dancing as soon as she could walk. Her personality and her style were as bright as her smile. She was 17.
Mary Kenny.
Popular. Kind, funny, passionate about fashion and dancing. A fan of Leeds United. She'd just turned 19.
Margaret Kiernan.
A friend to all who loved sport and loved socialising, loved to sing Roxanne, and who dreamt of a happy future in a house next door to her best friend Deirdre. She was 18.
Sandra Lawless.
Happy, kind, funny, selfless. A Girl Guide leader. Swimmer who won awards for life-saving. She loved hiking and camping in the Dublin mountains. She was 18.
Francis Lawler.
An army man with a love of style. He'd great leadership skills and he never liked to leave his beautiful baby Lisa. He was 25.
Maureen Lawler.
A loving and devoted mother to Lisa. Full of dreams for the future, she shared an interest in fashion with her husband Francis, was always immaculately dressed. She was 26.
Paula Lewis.
Was her mother's right-hand woman and her father's pride and joy. She was a second mother to her siblings and her little sister's roommate. She was 19.
Eamon Lockman.
A protector of his brothers and sisters who remember the crossbars on his racer. A car enthusiast, a music lover with a deep laugh. He was 18.
Donna Mahon.
A lovely person who loved her job working in the newsagents, meeting people and being part of the community. She plans to go to Santa Ponsa for her 18th birthday. She was 17.
Helena Mangan.
Kind, caring, loving, brave, strong. Her daughter Samantha was the centre of her life. She loved to dance. She was 22.
George McDermott.
A gentle music lover with a cheeky grin. He loved to bop and playing cards with his pals. He was 18.
Marcella McDermott.
Happy, singing and dancing with the most gentle and kind nature, especially with children. She was 16.
William McDermott.
Willie. A gentle giant with a beautiful smile, soft-voiced, witty, caring, kind. He loved the weekend, the Dubliners, and being on Hill 16. He was 22.
Julie McDonald.
Caring, helpful, thoughtful, a hard worker and provider. She loved football. She coached a local team. She was mad for Elvis. She was 20.
Teresa McDonald.
The focal point of her family. She was brave. She stood up for what she believed in and she loved all animals. She was 16.
Gerard McGrath.
Independent and full of energy, talented with his hands, a dapper music lover. He had a passion for the natural world and a love of birds. He was 21.
Caroline McHugh.
An avid reader, Irish dancer, swimmer. A member of the local CB radio club who did well in school and work. She was 17.
James Miller.
A sailor who travelled the world. So happy to be engaged, to be married and ready to settle down and raise his family. He was 20.
Susan Morgan.
A tomboy who loved football and walks in Dublin. She was bubbly. She was funny. She was full of life. She was 19.
David Morton.
Football mad and named Chesty for preferring to receive the ball there than have it mess up his hair. He was mischievous. He was charismatic. He was independent and he had big dreams for the future. He was 19.
Kathleen Muldoon.
Good natured. Thoughtful. She wanted to be a nurse and cared for all those around her. She was 19.
George O'Connor.
Gentle homebody with a creative spirit. He loved science fiction. He was attending his very first dance. He was 17.
Brendan O'Mara.
Talented Irish dancer and sportsman. He'd help anyone out in any way he could and never had a hair out of place. He was 23.
John Stout.
Sensitive, gentle, also an Elvis fan. He likes snooker. He planned to become a painter and decorator to contribute to the family household that he loved. He was 18.
Margaret Thornton.
A lover of fashion, music, skilled in dressmaking and tailoring. She loved the pictures, concerts, and especially discos. She was 19.
Paul Wade.
A people person. Good at chatting. He made friends easily. Someone you simply couldn't stay mad at. He was 17.
48 young people who had all their lives ahead of them, but whose lives were extinguished on the night of the 13th going into the 14th of February, St. Valentine's Day, 1981, by a fire that ripped through the Stardust nightclub, killing each of those 48 people who were unlawfully killed and to whom the Taoiseach delivered a state apology to yesterday.
As Taoiseach, on behalf of this state, I apologise unreservedly to all the families of the Stardust victims and all the survivors for the hurt that was done to them and for the profoundly painful years of struggle for the truth. I apologise to the families that those present on the night of the fire were wrongly criminalised through the allegation of arson, which was an attack on their reputations. I say today clearly in Dáil Éireann, every person there was innocent. I say today the truth is now known, and I say today not only were they innocent, they were unlawfully killed.
On Taoiseach, Simon Harris delivering a state apology to the Stardust families yesterday. We'll have an in-depth report on that very lengthy session that took place in Dáil Éire and ran over a period of some 4 hours yesterday, later on in the programme today. But if you'd like to make comment on our programme today, let me remind you, as always, that you're very welcome to do so, and we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 0419832000. Text or WhatsApp 086-1800-658. Email michael@lmfm.ie.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Humanity has been cast into an era devoid of effective international rule of law, and it is innocent civilians who get caught up in conflicts who are paying the highest price. So this is according to the annual report from Amnesty International, which is being published this morning. Stephen Bowen, Executive Director with Amnesty International Ireland, joins us now. And a very good morning to you, Stephen, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. Every year, Amnesty publishes its report highlighting the human rights violations that occur around the world. But this year, probably worse than any year before it, and I'm sure top of the list is what's happening in Gaza. And Israel comes under some criticism from Amnesty, but maybe you begin by telling us about how Israel's fight in Gaza, its war against Hamas, is being compounded, as you say, by its allies, countries like the US, UK and Germany.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for inviting us onto the show. We see, don't we, in the campaign of collective punishment that Israel has waged against Gaza, following the horrific Hamas attacks on October the 7th, we see it's a campaign of deliberate and indiscriminate bombing of civilians. It's a campaign to prevent humanitarian aid getting into the Gaza Strip. It's a campaign of enforced famine. And the only thing which makes the situation even darker is that Israel's allies have sat by largely and allowed this to happen. We see that the United States repeatedly vetoed a call for a ceasefire. And we are fearful that the entire post-World War II international system of the rule of law that was put in place to promise never again is at the brink of collapsing around us. It is truly shocking, for example, that even now, today, an arms shipment are going to Israel for it to use in its campaign of collective punishment in the Gaza Strip.
The Americans would argue that those arms were ordered many months ago.
And they could not be shipped. Mm. What difference does it make when the arms were ordered? Yeah? We all know that when those arms get to Israel, and there is a near certainty they will be used to carry on this campaign of collective punishment in Gaza. Mm. I think it is so truly shocking that we can't compel Israel to allow a ceasefire to take place, to allow the entry of humanitarian aid, to create a platform for the release of all hostages, and to end this unspeakable situation which is unfolding.
Mm. The civilians, as you say, caught up in it, not just because of the bombs and bullets, the tanks and the planes, but also because of what are unthinkable war weapons or weapons of war, famine, water denied to people, and healthcare.
Absolutely right. Let's also remember that what is going on in the Gaza Strip right now has not emerged from a vacuum. Amnesty International's research, which we published just a year or so ago, showed that the system that Israel has imposed in Gaza and the occupied West Bank is a system of apartheid, where one group is deliberately putting in place and sustaining a system of subordination, and it's the crime of apartheid. And so we already have this terrible situation that the world has failed properly to address.
Mm.
And on top of that, we now have civilians absolutely being cast aside because we are not able to obey the international rules.
Mm. Yeah, and we watch it every day on our TV screens, and we're appalled. We're actually talking about it, which is somewhat unusual when it comes to conflicts around the globe. I'm not sure the last time I heard somebody mention Sudan, where famine is taking place and rape is a war crime that is commonplace.
No, it's of course very true, and we draw attention in our report to situations of conflict, of the widespread use of sexual violence as a weapon of war in places like Sudan, in Ethiopia. The situation in Myanmar continues to be largely neglected by international actors, and we see also the Russia's crimes of aggression in Ukraine targeting civilians. So we are able to see that the world is clearly on the brink of nightmare scenarios, and the time has come for people to, if you like, step up to the plate and live by the international rules rather than clearly flouting them.
All of this atrocity taking place at a time of remarkable technological advances, but those atrocities compounded to some degree by artificial intelligence. We hear of AI being used to set bombs on Palestinians in Gaza, for example.
Well, we are genuinely worried about the rapid pace of advances in relation to artificial intelligence and what we call big tech generally. We see a move towards the use of autonomous weapons where, if we're not careful, we are going to have a situation where artificial intelligence is driving weapon systems. We've called for a complete ban on that. With the wider question that we've drawn attention to today in our global report, though, is that we've long understood that the surveillance-based business model of big tech, their mass harvesting of people's data, and the way that the algorithms that they design, what we call content-shaping algorithms, all of these things together create a situation where people are at risk of no longer having free and unfettered access to information. That information is only available in the way, if you like, the algorithms provide it to us. And what these algorithms do, because they're designed to maximize the person's engagement at all costs, what these algorithms do is they amplify division, they amplify hatred. So we are in a situation where already the world is becoming polarized. There is certainly just not enough kindness in the world and far too much hate. But the very infrastructure of what is now the dominant means of communication, social media, is in fact designed to amplify that division, because that's what drives the engagement, which is the business model of big tech.
Right. There's a concern about new technology being introduced here. And I see Amnesty International Secretary General Agnes Callamard talking about facial recognition as a pernicious foe. Is Amnesty asking the Irish government to think twice before introducing facial recognition here?
Oh, we're asking them not to introduce facial recognition. We think facial recognition is pernicious. It is definitely not yet capable of being delivered in a way which respects people's human rights, and it should not be introduced.
Predominantly because it is accurate for the most part with white males, and
yes, I mean, you know, it's like a lot of these AI it's like a lot of these AI systems. They replicate the biases that are already in our society, and then we lose control of them. So we have a number of complaints and problems with facial recognition. Of course, one of the most immediate problems is these systems are being adopted and introduced far in advance of our capacity to regulate them. And that's a major, major problem. But with facial recognition technology, yes, it does not work in the way that governments like to claim it work. And in the process of not working well, our human rights are placed significantly at risk.
Okay, the state of the world's human rights is the title of the annual report from Amnesty International, which is being published today, which looks at human rights in 155 countries around the world. One of those, of course, is Ireland. How does Ireland fare? I imagine we're one of the better countries to live in the world, but at the same time, a country that's not without its flaws.
No, of course. I mean, we are lucky to live in a country like Ireland, which has lots of human rights laws and protections that often do work. But there are also some persistent flaws. Now, we've drawn attention today in our global report to a number of matters. So one of them is access to abortion services. So the 28 referendum. It was an historic moment, not only for Ireland, but for the world, because it sent a really positive message around the world, where in many parts of the world, access to healthcare and abortion services for women is still a distant dream. It sent a message around the world that change was possible, even in places where there were still some traditional ideas about these matters. So it was a really, really positive moment for Ireland and for the world, but it was a start, not the end. And here in Ireland, for example, we fought very hard for the law that was introduced after the referendum to be subject to a review after 3 years, and that review came out last year. Mm. That review points out how access to abortion is still patchy. It points out that what people call conscientious objection by healthcare providers is very problematic in restricting access. And, you know, we've pointed out that there is no human right to withdraw healthcare from someone because of a conscientious objection. Mm. And it's something which needs really urgent and continuing attention. So no woman...
And the ongoing criminalisation... Or potential criminalisation. And indeed the three-day wait, which has been criticised.
The rather strict definition of fetal abnormality. Mm. I mean, it just needs a lot of improvement. Mm. And
it seems the government's position on that right now, Stephen, is that a review was promised, the review happened, and that's the end of it. Simon Harris, the new Taoiseach, was saying that at the time the referendum wording was published, so was the draft legislation. And he seemed to imply that the government would be breaking its word if it was to change that legislation now.
I fear that we fundamentally disagree with that analysis. The people voted to allow the government to legislate on this matter, and they did not vote for whatever was in the heads of agreement and the other preliminary documentation. Yeah. We argued at the time very clearly that this review should be a review of the law and how the law is operating, and the government insisted that it would be only a narrow review of how the law was operating. But even when we look at that review of how the law is operating, there are very significant shortcomings that need to be addressed. And so this is something we'd like to draw attention to.
And I gather that it can be argued that people voted for the draft legislation, but they also voted for a review because it was enshrined in that referendum proposal. Housing, though, of course, tops your list in terms of how people's human rights are not being fulfilled by the state.
Yeah, we're very concerned about the situation with the housing crisis in Ireland. The We see the housing crisis as fundamentally a human rights crisis. The figures on homelessness, including child homelessness, are truly shocking. But in many ways, although those figures around homelessness, street homelessness, are so shocking, they're kind of a symptom of the wider underlying problem, which is that government after government has engaged in failure after failure in not putting in place proper right to housing protections here in Ireland. And we've argued since 2014 that we should enshrine in our constitution the right to housing. It always makes the difference when the human rights that you have promised to deliver to your people are backed up by the force of law. And we have been part of a coalition that has got that government commitment to have a referendum on housing. There's been a review of the public housing commission that's still not been published. And this is something which really, really needs addressing, because here in Ireland, we've ended up in a situation where housing is seen more as some kind of investment opportunity rather than a social good and a human right. Yeah. And we worry that generations of young people are simply never going to be able to afford a home of their own.
Yeah, a luxury, not something that people could consider to be a necessity if we keep on the road that we're on. Stephen, I have to leave it there for the moment, though. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme today. Stephen Bowen, Executive Director with Amnesty International Ireland.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Speaking of human rights, imagine this. As we speak, there are 28 million people who are trapped in the hands of human traffickers and states that are forcing them to work for little or no pay. Now, that's according to the Rapporteur for the Internal Market Committee of the European Union, who says the fact that the EU has a law to ban these products is one of the biggest achievements of this mandate and a victory for progressive forces. This follows a vote in the European Parliament yesterday to ban products made with forced labour from coming into the single market because, as Maria Manuel Lato Marcus says, Europe cannot export its values while importing products made with forced labour. Let's speak to Karen Coleman, who is the editor with EU News Radio, which covers EU news for Irish radio stations. Good morning to you, Karen. Thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. How is this going to work in practice?
Well, this is something that we are going to get more details on now over the coming years. But as you said yesterday, 555, a big majority of the MEPs, approved this draft text, which will get the final approval from the 27 EU member states shortly, and then it's going to come into law within the next 3 years. There are sort of different elements to this, but according to the new rules, the European Commission is going to be responsible for carrying out investigations into cases of forced labour outside the EU. And one would imagine that that will apply probably for the majority of products for which maybe, or there will be concerns about whether forced labour was used in their production. And then if there are suspicions that forced labour has been used for products produced within the EU, then the member states are supposed to carry out those investigations. And then if those investigations conclude that forced labour has been used either for products made outside the EU or within the EU, those products, goods, will have to be withdrawn from the EU single market itself and also from online marketplaces. Then they can either be, according to these draft rules, which are going to be approved by the Council, they'll be donated, recycled or destroyed.
Right. And will people like this? I wonder. I think on the face of things, there's no argument here. 28 million people in forced labour, and that includes over 3 million children who are producing goods in sweatshops. Nobody wants that, but a lot of people want fast fashion and other cheap products, don't they?
Well, this is, of course, this has been an issue, particularly when you talk about the rag trade and cheap clothes that are piling up on our markets and, of course, not least creating environmental problems as well. Many people want access to cheap clothes, but you have to ask then, if a product can be made so cheaply, who is benefiting ultimately from it? And I mean, that figure from the International Labour Organization that you quote there, Michael, is staggering. Nearly 28 people engaged in forced million and over 3 million children involved in them. Now, the sweatshops in countries have been highlighted as places where forced labour is being used, and particularly the forced labour of children. But of course, there are also other areas, including domestic abuse, so of labour, people working in domestic situations and getting hardly anything, if nothing, for their labour. Also farm workers, also producing products that may end up on our shelves at fairly cheap prices. And these are will be very yeah. hard, I think, to figure out and to gauge. Now, the Commission is supposed to be establishing a database with specific economic sectors with in various parts of the world where it's suspected forced labour is being conducted. But I think it is going to be challenging to be able to really pinpoint what products are coming into our market, what products are we consuming, eating, wearing, etc., using. For example, solar panels have been cited as area from China, from the Uyghur section in the Xinjiang province of China, where forced labour is being used in their production as well. I think it's going to be challenging to really be able to...
And there's a lot of money involved.
Specifics in it.
A lot of money involved.
And a lot of money involved.
Little or no money at one end, but a lot of money at the other end. And it's at that end where you're going to get the greatest resistance. Whatever about people's preferences or whether they give a damn or not about how something has been produced so cheaply. It is those who are making the profits who have all of the clout in this, and there is going to be huge resistance, I imagine.
Well, yes, and I think the figure is that it might be something like 80, this might apply to about 80% of the private sector. There's an element of state-sponsored slave labour involved in the production of goods, but of a lot of it, a lot of those products are coming from areas, from production sectors that are run by the private sector. And yes, obviously, the higher wages they may have to pay to those who produce those products, then the higher prices they're going to have to charge. So it's always about, in these instances, the bottom line and how cheap can you get a product onto a competitive market like the EU single market. And it comes back to the wider question, you know, which you've been alluding to, which is for all of us as consumers. And this applies as much to, of course, as you know well from farming communities in your constituency, Michael, is, you know, we all like to have cheap chickens, cheap vegetables on our supermarket shelves. But the people who produce those will argue that, you know, they don't get very much money for those products if they're sold very cheaply. So it's a question for all of us as consumers. I suppose we need to ask, if we're getting a product very cheaply, then what's the cost to the provider of that product, and maybe the person who's sewing a button in a cheap blouse that we may be buying, or a shirt which we may be buying in our shops.
Yeah, we can choose not to buy those clothes, or we can choose not to buy products that come from countries who are dropping bombs on innocent people and children, for that matter. But we don't need laws for that. There are decisions to make now if we choose, but hopefully these laws will change the options that are available to people in the coming years. Karen, thank you indeed for joining us this morning. Karen Coleman, editor with EU News Radio, which covers EU news for Irish radio stations.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Now, let's say good morning to Fiona Looney. Fiona will be known to you for many reasons. Indeed, she's famous for many reasons. But today we're introducing her as World Vision Ireland Ambassador. Good morning to you, Fiona, and thank you indeed for joining us.
Good morning, Michael.
Good to talk to you. Tell us a little bit about your work with World Vision. In fact, maybe you tell us about the COFRA project, which has come about because of a child that you sponsor in Uganda, and indeed your visit there.
Yeah, so Basically, I've been sponsoring children in Africa through World Vision Ireland for about 20 years. And last year, because they're very nice people, they brought me over to meet my sponsored child. And like that was an amazing experience. And a lovely little 8-year-old boy, he's 9 now, he's probably taller than me. He was on a fine stretch. But one of the things that we did when we were over there was we went into a couple of schools in the area. These are World Vision Ireland supported schools. And, you know, you kind of, you know, I went from obviously a very sheltered, you know, ordinary Dublin background and came into, you know, first of all, Africa, which I'd never been to before. And, you know, meeting John, the child and his family, and it was all wonderfully positive experiences. You know, you could see what was possible with very little, you know, and like how people would use what little they had to maximize their lifestyles, you know, and just, but, you know, they are very poor. But when I went into the schools, I genuinely was horrified. There's no other way to describe it.
Why so?
You walk in. Well, the first one I went into, they're all very similar. I mean, the kids are just gorgeous. They have the most beautiful, vivid school uniforms. You know, they have these kind of, like, you know, flaming pink and orange and just gorgeous stuff. And they're really welcoming and they've all these, you know, they meet you outside and they have dances of welcome and songs and all this. But when you walk into the classroom, the first classroom I walked into, I looked around and my first thought was, people would think twice about housing livestock in a room like this in Ireland. Mm. You're talking about, you know, sheds, basically, concrete sheds, block sheds, no glass in the windows, no doors in the doorways. I mean, the very fact that they don't have doors tells you there's nothing to steal there. They've broken furniture, bare walls. And I think for me, the biggest shock, as well as the state of the room, was the sheer number of children in it.
Right.
So they're all there smiling and clapping and singing their song, welcome. How many kids are in this room? So I asked the teacher in the first room, and she told me there were 200 children in that class.
Right.
Like 200 children. Yeah, I mean, we complain about the pupil-teacher ratio here. And 200 children and one teacher.
Yeah. So I remember being in primary school with 44 or 45 children in a class, and it was just mayhem. How can any teacher control 200 children?
Absolutely. And that, so, you know, I kind of came away from the first school being kind of, you know, very sort of depressed by the experience, because realistically, you know, we are, like, as individuals and even as a collective in Ireland, we can't go and say, let's build more schools, let's hire more teachers. You just can't, you know, because you're dealing with foreign governments. You know, there's an awful lot of red tape. And also, it would cost massive amounts of money. But when I went into the second one, I was used to the experience. And then I looked around and I thought, OK, I know what's missing here. Now, listen, there's a lot missing there. But one of the things that really occurred to me was they didn't have resource material. So, you know, some of them have pictures.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
on the wall, but they're kind of, you know, they've been made by the teachers. But if you think back to the classrooms that, you know, that you and I would have been in as children, you know, that this generation's children, you know, go to now, and you think of those sort of like laminated flashcards that were always on the wall with the alphabet, you know, or, you know, in our case, it would have been obviously, you know, half English, half Irish or whatever. And then we all had a COFRA. I'm sure you had one as well, Michael. You know, the stationery press in every classroom, which had all the resource materials, like in our case, it was Mala, which is not something that even exists anymore, as far as I know. But, you know, full of paints and all these shared art materials, workbooks, worksheets, you know, shared textbooks that you'd have one between two. They have kind of one textbook between six or seven kids over there, you know, and they're in an office. And I kind of thought, it wouldn't be a massive financial outlay to try and put in a COFRA, and you know, a kind of equivalent into these classrooms. And by doing that, you know, the kids learn really well when they use their hands, because if they think they're playing, they don't realise they're learning, you know, and like, you'll see now every primary school in the classroom, the first half an hour of every school day is given over to playing with the equipment that's in the COFRA, you know, be it kind of magnets or whatever it is. So that's where the COFRA project was born.
Very good. I mean, you know, is the idea to bring a COFRA, these basic work tools, to classrooms then across Africa?
Well, what we really want to do is provide these materials in the World Vision Ireland supported schools, which are in Uganda and Tanzania. But, you know, like from small acorns, mighty oaks grow. So, like, it is possible, you know, if we can get these sort of resources into classrooms in these areas, you know, other areas can look, other charities, other NGOs can look, and, you know, possibly we can start something that could spread beyond. I mean, we are really focusing on the schools that are World Vision supported. You know, we've set what we think are really low budgets, because we would love schools in Ireland to get involved in this. You know, have a cake sale, have a movie night, have a jersey day or a funny hat day or whatever. But to get kids involved, because I know when my own kids, one of the reasons I started child sponsorship was, it's a great way of, you know, when your kids are going, I want, life's not fair, why can't I have?
You're saying, look at John.
Yeah, absolutely. And to make them aware of kids their age who are going to schools, you know, as they are, but in such a radically different and, you know, under-resourced environment. So we're sort of encouraging people, you know, we're not shooting for the stars here. We're talking about, you know, €1,000 we can kit out a classroom. €8,000 we can fully kit out three classrooms.
Right.
You know, but all points in between, all points lower. You know, I'm not saying please donate a grand.
Euro,
you know, donate £10, and we'll get there. So it's really just to encourage that, but also, you know, just to kind of, you know, I suppose everyone remembers, and I haven't thought about my own COFRA, you know, for a long time, but, you know, that lovely cabinet of possibilities that you're dying to get your hands on every day as a child, you know. I mean, obviously in secondary school, ours were mainly used for locking other children in and then pushing them out into the corridor to get them into trouble, you know.
Well, I'd expect no less from Fiona Looney, yes. Okay, right. Well, what made you decide to go to Uganda, though?
Well, that's where my sponsored child was.
Yeah, but so, you just were curious then, because you were sponsoring this child over a period of time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so with child sponsorship, it's not just kind of, you know, sign the direct debit. You get letters from the child, you get school reports, so, and you get photographs. So you do kind of feel you know the child.
Yeah.
And then when World Vision, you know, asked me if I wanted to go out to meet John, like, obviously I jumped at the chance to go out there. And it was an extraordinary, it's a beautiful country, first of all, but an extraordinary experience to see. Because I was, you know, to be honest, and again, this kind of comes back to what we're doing here. I was kind of going, am I a bit of a fraud out here? Like, I literally give €25 a month. Like, you know, it's kind of like, I barely kind of, you know, I certainly don't break sweat doing it. And I was kind of going, like, I'm not, you know, I'm not Mother Teresa. You know, I don't know the kind of...
No.
You know, I'm not sure that I'm making a difference. But when you go out there, you realise, like, they were so grateful to me. I mean, mortifying in a way, you know, but...
A rude awakening, by the sounds of it, Fiona. And a realisation of how so little can spread so far for a small amount of money, as you
yes,
say.
The power, like the power of one. I was really, really taken by the power of one. I kept saying to them out there, I kept saying, I do nothing. And they were showing me various projects. They're going, this is not nothing, you know, and you realise, you know, I'm just one person, obviously, you know, giving them €25 a month. But all the other people who do that, you know, it does actually turn into something very tangible. And that's what we're trying to do with this.
Well, it's a fantastic thing. I suppose we sit here talking about the world's problems every day, helpless to some degree, sitting on our hands in part. But here's a chance to do something if people do wish to help with the COFRA project. They can donate through worldvision.ie, I think is...
it's worldvision.ie/COFRA. But if you go to the World Vision website, you'll see it there. And you can either as a group, you know, you can commit to doing like, a cake sale or whatever within a school, but also obviously individual donations. You know, we're not turning anyone away on this.
Mm. Well, I hope it raises an awful lot of money. Congratulations on that work that you're doing, Fiona. Always nice to talk to you. And thank you for joining us today. That is Fiona Looney, who is World Vision Ireland Ambassador.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Well, we've actually been flooded with calls today, and thanks to everybody who's been in touch with us so far. Let me give you a taste of what people have been saying to us. Christine Arkins has been texting us. Texted us some time ago following our opening piece this morning, where the Taoiseach remembered the 48 lives that were lost in the Stardust tragedy. And Christine said, "My God, Michael, God rest their souls." Thank you, Christine, for that. A number of people found it hard listening, but I think we should all remember the Stardust families, and that's the sense I'm getting from you this morning as well. Doreen has been in touch to say, what can one say to all of those families who've had to live with a life sentence for over 40 years? I'm so sorry for your huge loss, and hopefully you have a bit of peace in your life going forward, as much as you can have, because you loved those who you have lost so much, and perhaps there'll be less suffering for you now. Live now for them is Doreen's message to the Stardust family. Somebody else says, I think the farce yesterday by the government is too little too late. They should be ashamed of themselves. 43 years too late. My heart goes out to the families of the victims. May they rest in peace. If it was one of mine who perished, I would never have accepted that so-called apology. What a disgrace. Thank you indeed. I think the 48, or the families of the 48, were delighted for the sake of their loved ones and felt it was a vindication for them. Angela said, Michael, very hard to listen to all of that. Brian O'Neill texting saying, I'd like to say that Simon Harris did well with the state apology on behalf of the state, but that shouldn't have been the only apology from the Dáil. The Labour Party had been in numerous governments since 1981. And the Stardust disaster. Where is their apology? Where was the noise from Sinn Féin over this disaster through the years? Every leader of every party in the Dáil should be apologising too for their non-action on this. It took 43 years. Thanks, Brian. We'll hear some of those apologies that you're looking to hear in a moment. Not all of them, because the debate went on for 4 hours or it wasn't a debate, it was statements. But each of the political parties and indeed the independents expressed how sorry they felt and felt that the state should have apologised to the families. And I don't think there was any exception to that, Brian. So I hope that answers your question. And stay with us and we'll hear some of the things that were said. Davey was in touch. He says, excuse me. Hats off to the new Taoiseach on how he handled the state apology. It was thoughtful, respectful and an emotional address he gave. And it was good to see him be direct and open with the families when he outlined how the state had failed them. More of this, please, says Davy. Emma in touch too. Emma says she was very emotional watching events in the Dáil yesterday. She found the speech given by the Taoiseach to be heartfelt, incredibly moving, and the dignified grief and relief of the families was palpable. It was very fitting that the families were given such a contrite apology. They've suffered for over 40 years in their fight for justice, and it's only right that their loved ones can now rest in peace. Tom in touch too, and he says, although this apology will not bring back their loved ones, hopefully it will go some way towards healing some of the hurt the families have suffered over the years. Their fight for justice for their loved ones is beyond inspiring. They refuse to give up on the people they loved and lost, and their determination has finally paid off. Tom says he hopes that what has happened this week will help bring them a little peace. Anne in touch with us too. She says fair play to Simon Harris for the way he handled the apology. He struck just the right note with his speech, respectful and contrite. Those families deserved every word of that apology, and it was very touching. Excuse me. Anne says it was very touching to see how much happiness it brought them. Hopefully now they can rest a little after so many years of fighting for justice. Mary in touch with us too, and she says she found the events in the Dáil very moving to watch. It was clear to see how much the apology meant to the families, and she would fully back the idea of an annual memorial ceremony to mark what happened. The victims deserve it, and their families deserve to have their lost loved ones honoured by the country. Thank you indeed for that. As I mentioned a moment ago, we're going to hear some of the contributions that were made in the Dáil yesterday, and we'll hear more of what Taoiseach Simon Harris had to say now.
I know there have been many, many times when you thought this day would never come, over far too many, many years. I know that you were forced to endure a living nightmare, which began when your loved ones were so cruelly snatched from you in a devastating fire. Their unfinished stories became your story, the defining story of your lives and the lives of your parents and other family members who left this life before ever seeing justice. I am deeply sorry that you were made to fight for so long that they went to their graves never knowing the truth.
And the Taoiseach was, of course, apologising on behalf of the state.
Today we say formally and without any equivocation, we are sorry. We failed you when you needed us the most. From the very beginning, we should have stood with you. But instead, we forced you to stand against us.
Everyone who was in the Stardust nightclub on the 13th going into the 14th of February 1981 was remembered.
48 young people lost their lives in the Stardust disaster. Many more were injured, and even more still had their lives broken and shattered forever. When I met with you in government buildings last Saturday, you reminded me of another time when four of your family members waited for days in the cold security hut, protesting your exclusion and hoping for access. I truly hope that the days since last Thursday have marked a turning point, and here today in Dáil Éireann, we finally begin to put things right. To bring you in from the cold and end the neglect of 43 years waiting and fighting for the only thing you ever wanted, the truth. Nothing else, no other agenda, just the truth.
The state apology to the Stardust families was an unequivocal apology.
I hope this is a moment when the state, which rubbed salt in your terrible wounds, starts to help you heal.
And there were some terrible wounds, and those wounds were opened to some degree yesterday by statements from TDs who, throughout most of this period, represented the people in Artane, one of them, Richard Bruton.
I think the initial determination of arson was seen as a further slap in the face to the families and to the victims themselves. The burning sense of injustice has fired these families throughout a very long struggle, And we who have represented them in the constituency have failed them, and I acknowledge that fully.
Richard Bruton acknowledging his failure, as did Sean Haughey.
For my own part, I genuinely believe that I consistently followed up any issues the committee asked me to do. I raised various matters in the Dáil. I wrote to the relevant ministers as requested. But if I'm honest, though, this was not enough. I also admit that my relations with the committee were at times fraught, and I do regret that. I admit, too, that when Pat McCartan issued his finding in 2017 to the effect that no new inquiry was warranted, I could not see how the case could be advanced further.
The apologies from Fianna Fáil's Sean Haughey and Fine Gael's Richard Bruton have been rejected by the families, who say they were annoyed and angered to hear them apologise now. Another TD for that constituency in Dublin Bay North is Denise Mitchell.
I can't remember exactly what was on the TV that day, but I remember flicking through the stations and the news of the Stardust came up on the screen. I remember running upstairs to wake me dad to tell him about the fire. I remember the panic in his eyes as it dawned on him that that place would have been packed and that maybe some of his nieces or nephews would have been there. Last count, Carla, we had no house phone at the time, and the nearest phone was up the road from us. And when we got there, there was a queue of people, all distressed, who were all there for the same reason. They were trying to locate their loved ones and to make sure that they were okay. In the days that followed, we saw funeral after funeral, and a dark cloud hung over our community. A dark cloud that hung for far, far too long. The memories of that night will stick with our community forever. Generations of people will live with both the mental and the physical scars that have been caused not only by that fire, but by the treatment of people in our community by the state in the weeks, the months and the years that followed.
Sinn Féin's Denise Mitchell. Another Sinn Féin TD who spoke yesterday is Sean Crowe. Now, when Sean Crowe spoke yesterday, I think a lot of people stopped in their tracks. In fact, in the Dáil chamber, you could hear a pin drop.
There's not time to talk about the incidents, but I remember young people being arrested that night, Taoiseach. They were trying to break down the doors. With some of them had fire access that they were getting off firemen. I think there was another young person that rammed a car into the wall the toilet wall to try and get people out. The doors were locked, they were chained, and they couldn't get out. They couldn't get out. And I remember listening on the radio, Sean Reinhardt, who I knew years ago, used to be the secretary to the group, and Sean was talking about that night, and he survived severe burns. But he talked about the gasp when the lights went out, and the screams then followed. And I suppose for anyone of that generation, those screams will probably live with us, and clearly will live with their families. I remember when I was speaking in here in 2017, and one of my constituents was saying that the thing they always talked about in their home was that no one was ever prosecuted. Nothing ever happened. The owners of the nightclub were rewarded. If that's the word, they were I don't know what the word is, confiscated. Anyway, I've spoken too long, but I'm really happy for the families here today. I hope they find some solace in what they've heard from the Taoiseach. But I do think that, others have mentioned other victims and other people who have, you know, we've apologised to belatedly. And I think we need to collectively look at how we treat victims and their families. It changed a generation. We'll never be the same. I'll never be able to go into a nightclub or a pub cellar without looking to see if there's chains on the doors. I've been abroad and that's the first thing you look at. If you're in somewhere strange, you'll always look to see that. I wasn't into Stardust, but we're from that generation and it's changed us, and it's changed us hopefully for the better. But we need to look at those regulations. Why, you know, why they weren't implemented. I heard in the court of the fireball that went up, regulations, fire regulations that weren't followed through. And again, as I say, some people that owned that nightclub was rewarded. And I suppose that's the big question that hangs over today. Why was no one prosecuted?
Why was no one prosecuted? That's Sinn Féin TD, Sean Crowe. We'll hear more questions about why nobody was prosecuted and indeed if justice still can be accessed for the families of the Stardust victims after the break.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Well, as you heard before the break, Sean Crowe was asking why nobody was ever prosecuted for the fire that killed, unlawfully killed, 48 kids, 48 teenagers and young adults in 1981. 43 years later, we are here and we finally understand that there were no children in that building or young adults in that building playing with matches. They didn't set the Stardust on fire. It was unlawful killing. And there were other TDs who said they want somebody held accountable.
If those you loved were unlawfully killed, then someone unlawfully killed them. It is time for the Gardaí, the DPP and the Minister for Justice to do what is right. What would happen in any other case of corporate manslaughter in any other part of the city? There must be another day in court. Stardust will always be a scar, a tale of greed, a tale of recklessness, a tale of horror, of poisonous lies, but of resilience, of hope, of campaigning, and of truth. The Stardust families are heroes of this republic. We are honoured to be in their presence today. They would much rather not be here. They would much rather have seen their loved ones grow older in the last 43 years. But you have all made us want to be better, to work harder, to campaign more, to listen more, to judge less, and to speak the truth. The truth, we hope, has set you free.
Let's hope that's the case. Labour Party TD Éan O'Riordan there.
How is it that the only person who was ever persecuted following the unlawful killing of 48 young people in the Stardust fire was Christy Moore, the singer who wrote a song about the truth? How is it that the owner of the Stardust received €500,000 in compensation, whereas the family suffered 43 years of the struggle, the tarnishing of their reputations, of being implied that they were lying, and all the impacts, terrible impacts that they felt and the loss that they had suffered, but they had to fight for this moment.
That's Richard Boyd Barrett. And other people before Prophet TD, Paul Murphy, also spoke about justice and injustice.
Those who profited originally from the tragedy, again profiting from that ridiculous finding which had no basis in fact, being able to profit again to the tune of £580,000. Absolutely obscene. And that, as has been mentioned, those who tried to tell the truth were silenced. Incredible. And if you look at the words in the song that Christy Moore was singing, he's just saying, we don't know how the fire started. And they said that that was contempt of court, because they wanted to tell the lie that it was started by working class young people, could be any one of the victims, could be any one of the survivors. And incredibly found in contempt of court for simply saying that. Just to finish, we have to acknowledge, we now have acknowledgement that there was unlawful killing. But those who did the unlawful killing must be brought to justice.
That's Paul Murphy. Now we'll go to the leader of Sinn Féin, Mary Lou MacDonald, who remembered the events that led to a decision which was made some 5 years ago when the Attorney General of the day, Seamus Wolfe, announced that a new inquest would be held into the Stardust fire.
The light at the end of a very dark, long tunnel grew brighter, but once again the contempt of the state towards the families came to the surface. After 43 years of struggle, the state had attempted to exclude elderly parents of victims from access to legal support and to that very inquest. Families had to fight to ensure that inquest jurors were selected in a transparent way and so that jurors would have their incomes protected. More obstruction, more disrespect, more contempt. Behaviours, consistent behaviours that spanned more than four decades. At each and every turn, the state abused its power to bully, intimidate, pressure and coerce heartbroken mothers, grieving fathers and devastated families. Instead of the state standing shoulder to shoulder with the Stardust families, they lined up against them again and again and again. The state placed so little or no value on the lives of 48 working class young people whose lives were snuffed out in the Stardust ballroom. To the powerful, these young people and their families didn't matter. And that's the cold, hard truth.
And that cold, hard truth relates to the government of the day and the successive governments since 1981.
This travesty happened on the watch of successive governments, successive Taoiseach and successive ministers for justice. The hope of government was that the families would eventually stop, eventually shut up, eventually give up and eventually go away. Well, those governments forgot one very important thing. You don't mess with Dublin Mas. You don't mess with Dublin Dads. You don't mess with Irish mammies and daddies and families. Not when they're fighting for justice for their children. Because you will lose and they will win. Even if it takes them 43 long years, they will win. When they know they have right on their side, ordinary people keep going. And that's a lesson that those in power would do very well to remember.
And the Mas and the Das, the brothers and the sisters, and indeed the children of the Stardust victims, kept going for 43 years.
For 43 years, successive governments obstructed the revealing of truth. Justice was kept out of reach for those left to bear unimaginable loss. Birthdays, Christmases, christenings, weddings, more than four decades of family occasions with the trauma of that fire in Artane running through them. So this moment, this victory, this vindication is first and foremost for those unlawfully killed, for the survivors, for the courageous families who have lived for years with the pain of the lies, with the ghosts of unanswered questions and with the sorrow of the empty chair. The Buddhists say three things cannot be long hidden: the sun, the moon and the truth. For the 48 young people who never came home, finally the truth is revealed. For the survivors who have endured a lifetime of suffering, finally the truth has prevailed. and you, their families, brought the truth home for them. And now let justice flow like a river.
That's the Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou MacDonald. Now, for those of you listening to us in Artane and indeed further afield, affected by the Stardust tragedy, who have fought for justice for 43 years, let's once again hear the apology that was delivered on behalf of the state to the families by an Taoiseach, Simon Harris, yesterday.
As Taoiseach, on behalf of this state, I apologise unreservedly to all the families of the Stardust victims and all the survivors for the hurt that was done to them and for the profoundly painful years of struggle for the truth. I apologise to the families that those present on the night of the fire were wrongly criminalised through the allegation of arson, which was an attack on their reputations. I say today clearly in Dáil Éireann, every person there was innocent. I say today the truth is now known, and I say today not only were they innocent, they were unlawfully killed.
And that is that chapter in what has been a very long story so far that has spanned 43 years. It does appear as though the story has not concluded, and there could very well be more twists and turns as people seek justice now following the verdicts of the inquest into the deaths of those 48 young people of unlawful killing. We'll come to some more of the comments after the break. Just to remind you, if you'd like to comment, 0419832000 is our number. Text or WhatsApp 086 1800 658. Email michael@lmfm.ie.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Now, some more of the comments coming to us. Somebody saying, judges, solicitors, barristers, the court service, they can all do what they like with people. It's time for Simon Harris and Helen McEntee to bring about change, and people should stand together. Thank you for that. Marion Trim in touch with us about forced labour, saying, I was with my daughter. We were out shopping last week. She was buying clothes for my grandchild. And when I saw the price, immediately I thought of the people working in those sweatshops. I hope something is done about it, but then you and I know that in Ireland, the price of clothes, especially children's, will rocket. And there'll be people waiting in the wings for this to happen, and the ordinary Joe Soap will suffer like everything else, says Mary. Thanks for that, Mary. Margaret texting us today too, and she says she was surprised when we were speaking to Karen Coleman about this EU position, that she didn't mention the slavery of children in the Congo mines who work with their bare hands to get cobalt out for lithium batteries for electric vehicles. What is the EU going to do about that? Will they ban EVs that have batteries made from those mines? If they're banning products made through slavery, they can't pick and choose. It's all or nothing. Otherwise, it's hypocrisy. I take it the answer is yes, Margaret. I don't know, but as we discussed earlier on, I think that there'll be huge resistance coming from very powerful sources to what Europe hopes to do, which is to ban the sale of products that have been produced using forced labour. We'll see. A good point, though, as always, Margaret. Thank you for your message. Somebody else says, Michael, who were the government at the time covering up for when the Stardust fire happened? It took so long for the truth to come out. It won't take those kids' lives back, but someone was responsible for what happened. Why were the emergency exits locked? If there had been enough security staff, the doors wouldn't have been locked from the inside. There was some penny pinching going on. There was greed at play. And now we're living on in the old belief that it'll never happen again. Thanks for that. Peter, thanks for your text to the programme as well. He says the UK, like America, is responsible for the genocide in Gaza. After all, the British caused the problems with the Balfour Treaty. Thanks. He says Britain is up to its necks in gas and blood. Thank you, Peter, as always, for your message. Another text that comes to us from somebody about America saying that it is the United States that is the cause of most of the trouble in the world. Thanks for that. Paddy Duffy texting. Thanks as always for your message, Paddy. Paddy says, what's the chances that tomorrow scandals are occurring right now? Well, that's a very interesting question, Paddy. I don't know if you were listening yesterday. We had Independent Senator Eileen Flynn on the programme. And as we were talking about the attitudes towards travellers in this country, and indeed the racism, discrimination and the hatred that they endure on a daily basis. We were talking about the EU, the new EU Human Rights Commissioner, Michael O'Flaherty, and how he said that in time to come, future generations will look back on our generation now and say, how could you have been comfortable living through such hatred? In the same way that we look back on those who lived through slavery and turned a blind eye. Let's get some more insight into what it's like to be a traveller in this country.
It is that when we walk out of the chamber, we still face the institutional racism and discrimination and oppression as Irish travellers. And en route in a taxi this morning, when myself, Letitia and Emma and Samantha were coming over, we were all excited about giving the opportunity as Irish travellers to speak to our own issues and to our own lives. And, you know, you get into a taxi, where are you heading? We're heading to the Shannon. Oh, are you? What are you talking about? Traveller rights. You can get the feeling of the ice-cold sentiment in that taxi as soon as we said that. Next came, what are you talking about? Well, we're going to be talking about the fact that we have been surviving cultural genocide and assimilation attempts since the foundation of our Irish Free State. Oh, no need to bring big words into it. Are you going to talk about the ones that are giving you a bad name? So this is the lived reality that we're dealing with. We have to be held accountable for individuals in our community that we don't even know, as a means that non-travellers use this to justify their ill treatment and their racism towards us. And I think we can never get any step closer to the realisation of Irish traveller rights until we receive a state official apology for the 1963 Commission report About Us, Without Us. That's set the tone for our lived reality for the decades that followed. That set the tone for our lived intergenerational trauma. And I think that has to be said. It hasn't been said yet here today, and I thought it was very important to name it. I know I've gone off track on the topic of employment, but if you listen to me, it's closely interlinked.
All right. I hope that answers your question, Paddy Duffy. That was Rosemary Mohan, who was speaking in the Shannon at a meeting of the Oireachtas Committee on issues dealing with the traveller community, highlighting some of the everyday discrimination that travellers have to live with in this country. And we all know about it. And that idea that they should be talking about the ones who are bad apples instead of focusing on people at face value is just one of those issues. Accommodation is another problem, of course.
In 2022, over 1,000 traveller families, including over 2,500 children, have no permanent electricity or heating, are living in overcrowded homes designed for single families, and this is 246 more traveller families than the year before, and amounts to over 4,500 people nationally, the extent of which has been seriously neglected and underestimated. The lack of adequate response from the state is concerning. The disparity between the mere 44 units of accommodation built by local authorities from 2019 to 2022, when need was assessed, that 3,060 units also contrasts with the rate of 10,000 new houses built, delivered in the same time nationally. It exasperates both the challenge faced by the community and the absence of government oversight. And moreover, with travellers being 22 times more likely to experience discrimination in accessing the private rented accommodation.
Barney Joyce there. Now, when it comes to us living with what is obvious discrimination against the traveller community, well, the result is that people are losing their lives.
Travellers have one of the worst low life expectancies of any other minority ethnic group in Ireland. The overall traveller life expectancy is 66 years. This is 15 years less for traveller men and 12 years less for traveller women. Infant mortality almost 4 times higher than the national rate. Traveller mortality 3.5 times higher. Traveller suicide is 7 times higher and accounts for 11% of traveller deaths. The study found only 8 travellers were over the age of 80 years old. The study also showed that systemic racism exists within our health services. Less than half of all travellers had complete trust in healthcare professionals compared to the trust level found in the general population. Over half of travellers were concerned about the quality of care they received when they are engaging with health services. 40% of travellers reported discrimination accessing health services, which was supported by almost 7 out of 10 service providers who agreed that their services discriminated against travellers.
Food for thought for all of us. Patrick Riley there, also speaking in the Shannon. We might hear some of those contributions over the coming days, or more of those contributions over the coming days on the programme. It was fascinating stuff. Before we go, thanks to John, who says he's not a fan of Simon Harris, but the Taoiseach did a good job on the apology. He was contrite and sympathetic, exactly what the families deserved. Sarah wants to pay tribute to the families for their incredible determination and bravery over the past 40 years. They were a credit to their loved ones. She was delighted to see how much the apology meant to them, and she would fully support the idea of an annual ceremony to mark the anniversary. That's our programme for today. God willing, we'll see you for our next programme tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. right here on LMFM. Good morning. Bye-bye.
The Michael Reid Show Podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.